It's 4:06, and you're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, a look at today's Supreme Court decision on affirmative action in higher education. What will it mean for colleges and universities around the country?
First, tomorrow is World Book Night, an international effort to get books into the hands of people who don't normally read and have trouble getting access to books.
The event shares fiction and nonfiction alike, and in some cases it includes free books.
Carl Lennertz joins us. He's executive director of World Book Night here in the U.S. Carl, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
So tell us about World Book Night. What's the goal of World Book Night?
Well, we have several goals, but the main one is just to get a printed book to someone who may not ever have owned one before. That seems simplistic, but the larger goal is 500,000 books on one day, Shakespeare's birthday, to light or non-readers.
Why Shakespeare's birthday?
It began in the UK, so we can't take credit for that. They gave us Downton Abbey and World Book Night, and we gave them Fast and Furious and what else did we give them?
Teletubbies? I don't know.
No, there you go.
It's a fair trade. And there's also a Spanish connection, right?
There is. I'm glad that you know that. Yes, so way back when... Shakespeare's birthday is also the anniversary of the death of Miguel Cervantes. And in Catalan Spain, it's World Book Day, where you give a rose and a book to a loved one. And that actually morphed into a UNESCO World Book Day, mostly in Europe, where school children get a token to go get a book at school. And then about 5 years ago, at a British booksellers meeting, someone said, how about a World Book Night where we focus more on adult books? And let's do it on Shakespeare's birthday as well.
So what happens on World Book Night for people who are participating?
We spend the year beforehand signing up 25,000 volunteers. This is not a street corner, mass giveaway, like here's some water, here's some gum. It's very targeted, very focused. So people apply online with us. They tell us where they're going to go and why. They get 20 books. Chosen from a list that we select, and they apply to be a giver. And I know it sounds exclusive, but almost everybody gets in because people intuitively understand what we're doing. And then we approve them, and then they go online after that and pick a bookstore or library near them to have their box shipped to. They go in this week, they get the box, meet each other, and then on the 23rd, they go out to the place that they applied to go to.
Applied to go to distribute the books?
Yes. We actually don't use the word distribute. We say personally hand out.
Personally hand out. Okay.
And it's very, it's the personal one-on-one interaction is a big part of what this is all about.
I bet there's a whole lot of stories that happen from people who are doing this, are personally handing out these books. What happens? Have you heard any of these stories about some of the things, the responses that people get?
Oh my God! We're the three of us doing this campaign for 25,000 volunteers and the 500,000 books, and we're emotional basket cases because both in their applications they state where they're going to go, and they're going to women's shelters, food pantries, underfunded schools, homeless, and those are very sad to have to read about. But obviously, we're grateful they're doing it. But they're also going to bars and street corners and parks. It's a very emotional thing to decide where you're going to give your books. The two most emotional things that have stuck with me even since year one was a fourth grader who was handed a book, and he said, I've never smelled a new book before.
Wow.
And I've never not seen one all covered in scotch tape.
Oh, that's amazing.
And then a retiree at a senior citizen, when she was handed the book, she said, is this for me to keep? I've never owned a book in my life.
Wow.
So,
that is incredible.
Any of those times 500,000 are the stories we hear every year. And again, thanks to social media, we'll start hearing on the 23rd and for a full week afterwards, photographs and videos and personal testimonies. And, it's really funny what we've learned from year one, the experience is as life-changing for the giver as the recipient. They know when they're going into a food pantry or senior citizen home or a VA hospital or a courthouse for juvenile detention, that it's going to be, a rough experience, a challenge, not a rough, an emotional one. And the responses they get are so positive that they see that they've done a good deed.
And I guess the foundation of all of this is really just the power of what a book is, what a book can be to people.
It is. It's a simple act. It's, not as essential as food. But it's a really wonderful... there's not too many things you can give to somebody that either feel like, oh, what are you giving me? A CD, a bottle of water. What is it? But a book has this universal message of your intentions are wonderful. I accept this book as you intended, as something for me to enjoy, entertain myself with, escape with. And we've had a number of volunteer givers apply and write. Last year, I got a book when I was in a women's shelter. I'm now out. My life has turned around, and I'm a giver this year. And that's a wonderful thing to see. But you're right. A book is a wonderful thing. It's a very personal gift, and it means a lot to people, and to people who don't have them in their homes. We read that 40% of all Americans are more than 50 miles from a bookstore or a library. So there's a
like a book desert.
Well, to some extent, our two taglines are to give books to people who are light or non-readers, and our second line, those without the means or the access. And that's hopefully a nice way of saying without the money or the local access to books. And the digital, this whole e-book thing does not solve it for these people. There aren't a lot of working computers in a lot of schools or in senior centers. Sherman Alexie is famous for saying there aren't too many working computers on the res. So when a box of books arrives at a Native American school in South Dakota, 100 miles from anything, it's a big deal.
What are the books on the list this year that you're going to be giving to people?
Well, the list kept growing. I think we're up to 39 titles. The list kept growing. Every year we pick about 35, adult, young adult, fiction, nonfiction, a good mystery, a thriller, and some, quote-unquote, some good literature. Like Catch-22 is on there, which is a difficult, important book. But there's Hoot by Carl Hiaasen. We do the whole range of possibilities. But it's about one-third young adult, since a third of the books do go into schools, and then two-thirds older. We do a book in Spanish. This year, Twin I Was Puerto Rican by Esmeralda Santiago. We do two books in large print. We have our first graphic novel this year, The Same Difference by Derek Kirk Kim, which I just loved. But story, we Young Men in Fire about by Norm MacLean about the firefighters, I think written 30, 40 years ago. Tales of the City by Armistead Maupin. So a panel chooses them based on ethnicity, gender, accessibility, age, and even geography. We do want a book set everywhere. Last year we had Mike Perry's book, Population 485, and Mike was great, and he did an event at his local library. This year we have two Minnesota authors. We can't cover every state, but every region is covered.
Do you kind of hand prescribe the books for people, talk to them, find out what they like, and then choose a book accordingly?
No, that's a good question. Every giver gets 20 of the same book.
Okay.
And we do that for two reasons. We want them to be giving a book they personally read. So the interaction is not just, have you read a book lately? No, well, I personally love Garrison Keillor's Pontoon, or I personally love, Hoot by Carl Hiaasen. So it's the giver is, their heart is fully into it. Early on in our very first year, we decided it would not be one each of 20 books, because then the interaction when you get to the second 10 books is, would you like a book? Well, is it good? Oh, I haven't read this one. So and a lot of givers, do go out together. Mother, daughter, four or five teachers, three or four sorority sisters. People do pair up. So as they're interacting, there can be, oh, you don't want the YA? My partner here has an adult book.
So is there anything new going on this year?
Well, we have two new things going on this year. The volunteer givers like to write about their experiences, and they write blogs or post Facebook comments. We're going to have an essay contest with 10 winners by region. And those 10 best giver sharing stories will be in an ebook that we distribute free next year. And then the other new thing, we produced a free ebook this year with 10 stories by previous givers that we just selected. So we're all about printed books, over 500,000, but there is still a portion of the population who never uses their phone or tablet to read. And if the giver's in a park or a little league game or in a senior center and someone waves them off and goes, no, I have my phone, the World Book Night person can say, would you like a little free 80-page ebook for your phone? So we have a little digital plus ebook this year with 10 stories, and then a contest for 10 winners by region, 9 regions, and 1 for military bases for next year.
And where will you be giving people books on World Book Night?
Oh, my God. Oh, my. Well, I...
You're going to be all over?
In 5 places. Going to a local senior center on the Upper West Side at 5:30 to meet with them. But then during the day, we're actually putting 6,000 copies of Shakespeare's sonnets on the seats at 4 Broadway theaters.
That's excellent.
And at the end, and you might think that Broadway theater goers, you know, are not our target market. But after the curtain call, an actor comes out and says, it's Shakespeare's birthday, it's World Book Night. You, dear audience, are obviously well-read people. Please give the copy of Shakespeare's sonnets this week to someone that you know who maybe doesn't read very often.
Mm. Excellent. Well, I wish you a happy World Book Night. Thank you so much for joining us, Carl.
I really enjoyed it. Thank you. And if anybody wants to learn more about what we're doing and to be a volunteer next year, they can go to worldbooknight.org and read all about us and sign up for a newsletter for next year.
That was Carl Lennertz, Executive Director of World Book Night USA. We have a link to the World Book Night website on the Central Time Facebook page.
The Supreme Court today upheld a state's right to ban affirmative action in higher education within its borders. The court ruled 6-2 on this case from Michigan, in which voters approved a ban on affirmative action in public colleges and universities. Scott Jasek is with us now to talk about it. He's the editor of Inside Higher Ed. Scott, welcome to the show.
Thanks. Great to be here.
Well, this affirmative action keeps going to courts again and again over the years. How many times have we seen this Michigan case, one way or another, end up coming before the Supreme Court?
Well, they do keep coming back, but technically today's decision wasn't about affirmative action. Today's decision was about the right of state voters to pass referenda, even if those referenda affect minority citizens potentially different from other citizens. So you could oppose affirmative action and favor this decision or the opposite. The justices who wrote the plurality decision said they weren't writing about affirmative action.
Right. They made that clear. They're saying this ruling isn't a thumbs up or thumbs down on affirmative action, but it says that federal law doesn't protect college applicants in terms of discrimination when the state, either by referendum or by state law, gets rid of affirmative action policies. That was a complicated sentence. Did I get it roughly right there?
Right. Well, here's the way I would think about it. Last year, they ruled affirmative action in certain circumstances is legal. Colleges can consider race and ethnicity in certain cases. Today's decision says, while that's an option, you don't have to do it. And a state can decide we don't want to do it.
This was a Michigan case. Its impact is not limited to Michigan, though, is it?
Correct. There are several other states, most notably California, but also Washington State and a few others, that have similar referenda to the one in Michigan. And while technically this was about Michigan, had the justices ruled the other way, this could have overturned and likely would have overturned bans elsewhere.
Do you expect to see other states lining up? I've seen at least some rumblings here in Wisconsin and elsewhere saying, hey, now that the Supreme Court has ruled this way, maybe we need to bring this to the court in our state and take advantage of this ruling from opponents of affirmative action.
I wouldn't be surprised if this will embolden some, but a few things to remember. One is that states are widely varying in how easy it is to get an item on the ballot. So this may be possible in some states, not others. It's also the case that some of the states that were seen as most likely to pass this or a similar referendum already have done so. So I suspect we'll see more activity, but we're not going to see it in 50 states.
What was there were two judges dissenting, one abstaining. What did the dissenting justices say?
Sure. Well, they argued that this is denying minority citizens their rights. Under this, the logic by those who brought the suit is basically that if you're at the University of Michigan, if you care about the University of Michigan admissions policies, and let's say you want the University of Michigan to admit more students from Wisconsin or more students from Northern Michigan or more engineers or whatever your goal is, you can lobby the University of Michigan regents to adopt such a policy. If you want them to consider race in admissions, you can't. And what the lawsuit challenging the referendum said, and what the dissent basically said, is that that is a denial of political rights to minority citizens. They can't lobby for what they may want, while other groups can lobby.
Now, let's put this against the wider backdrop of how race and ethnicity are used in admissions policies around the country. There are probably as many policies as there are universities and colleges, but how are a lot of public universities in particular using race and ethnicity when they weigh what students to accept?
Sure. Well, first, a very important thing to remember is that most colleges aren't weighing race and ethnicity, not because of any affirmative action ban, but because they don't have highly competitive admissions to start with. So if you take University of Michigan, for instance, this case has had a most dramatic impact at undergraduate at the University of Michigan, and also at the professional schools throughout the state, law, medical school, and so forth. And that's typical of higher education elsewhere. Many public universities that aren't the flagships, this isn't a huge issue, at least in terms of actually making admissions decisions. On the other hand, these votes and these debates, this year's case, last year's case, can send a message to minority students, and they may feel more or less welcome based on what's being decided here. If you look at the comments that get posted on any discussion of affirmative action, you see a lot of negativity, shall I say. And so these cases both affect what a college can do and also the overall atmosphere.
What's the argument, especially at these flagship public universities or the elite private schools, in favor of affirmative action? Is it viewed more as people of different races need more opportunity, or is it we need to create a diverse environment for all our students? I've seen both of those out there.
Well, I think the legally successful argument is the latter. And if you look at the decision Justice Sandra Day O'Connor wrote some years ago about the University of Michigan case, she accepted the argument that the education of everybody depends on interacting with a wide range of students, not just students like yourself. In different states, though, different universities do have different motivations. There are states that once had de jure segregation, and they feel they may have a legal obligation to do extra outreach. There are states where their populations are changing rapidly, and they wonder about will they have the professionals from all backgrounds to serve the needs of a state. But the legal argument that seems the strongest is that an education at the University of Michigan, at the University of Wisconsin, would be deficient if you had all-white classrooms.
And then briefly on the critical side of affirmative action, the argument often is if you are biasing toward one race, you are therefore biasing against another race, therefore it's discriminatory.
That is indeed their argument. Another argument that is made in criticism of affirmative action is that many of the court decisions allowing affirmative action referred to a tip or a slight edge for members of certain groups. Many think that has grown too large. And in fact, a lot of polling suggests the public is more supportive of a modest help than a larger help to members of certain groups. There's also the question of how long it should be necessary. Notably, Justice O'Connor in 2003 said that she envisioned affirmative action no longer being necessary in 25 years. Well, we're well into that timeline. And one of the difficulties is that if you look at the way students are educated in high school, there are profound inequities in many high schools. And so in many states, your minority students are going to high schools that are not as good as those attended by other students.
We're talking about today's Supreme Court decision, U.S. Supreme Court decision on affirmative action in higher education. Scott Jasek is with us. He's editor of Inside Higher Ed.
You can join the conversation. Should colleges and universities be able to use race and ethnicity as factors when they decide who gets in? Should states be able to override college affirmative action policies? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email talk@wpr.org. We're talking about today's Supreme Court decision to uphold Michigan's ban on affirmative action on college campuses. We're joined by Scott Jasek. He's the editor of Inside Higher Ed.
And you can join the conversation. Do you think colleges and universities should be able to use race or ethnicity as factors when they decide who gets in? Should states be able to override college affirmative action policies at their public colleges and universities? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email talk@wpr.org. So, Scott, we've got this decision today. What kind of reaction are we seeing from college administrators, admissions people on this?
College administrators are mainly relieved that the court didn't touch last year's decision, which said that they could consider race. So they're always nervous when the Supreme Court does anything involving affirmative action that they could take it as a time to ban it altogether, which they didn't do.
So they took a narrower view, in effect, on this.
Correct. They just looked at this question of can a state ban it, not is it legal generally. Two justices, Scalia and Thomas, reiterated their longstanding belief that affirmative action should be barred, but they've said that before and they'll say it again.
Since that past Supreme Court decision that you mentioned, are there other challenges, more fundamental challenges, I guess, to college affirmative action in the legal pipelines?
Yes. In fact, last year's case involving the University of Texas at Austin went back for more hearings. And I suspect that case will be the next one to come back to the Supreme Court. Critics of affirmative action are hunting for plaintiffs, including at the University of Wisconsin at Madison, and they want to identify people on whose behalf to sue, and they've been fairly successful, particularly from a public relations perspective, at identifying students who they want to be the face of a challenge to affirmative action.
So this would be someone, ideally from their perspective, who says, hey, I'm white, I applied, my scores, etc., should have gotten me in. Because
right.
of affirmative action, I didn't get in.
And I was rejected. But the one difference between what you said is I think they're very interested in getting Asian plaintiffs as well. One point that the critics of affirmative action like to stress is that Asian candidates may also lose out, and they're really pushing that issue.
So how big a difference does affirmative action make in admissions at some of the universities we're talking about? How big a finger on the scale is it, I guess?
Well, there's no doubt that many universities that practice affirmative action will admit minority students with lower ACT, SAT scores, lower GPAs, On the other hand, it's important to remember, it's not just minority students. It's athletes of all races and ethnicities. It's students who can afford to pay their costs without financial aid, maybe alumni children, most likely to be white. So there are lots of groups that benefit from various forms of preferences. I think some people imagine that higher ed admissions is a pure meritocracy, and I don't think it's been that for a long time.
Are our colleges and universities kind of laboratories on this? Are they all trying something a little bit different, or is there kind of a state of the art now?
I think a lot of them are trying different things. And again, some of them may be targeting different groups. If you are in sort of parts of, in your part of the country, there are probably colleges that are very focused on Native American groups that are in the region. And that's the case in other states as well. There are some colleges that are very focused on their veteran populations or colleges that are focused on rural populations. So it's not just a matter of race and ethnicity. Places like UW-Madison tend to be get scrutiny from rural legislators who want to know it's not just the Milwaukee suburbs that are dominating the class.
Another critique of affirmative action that's been out there, and I think there's been back and forth research on this, suggests, hey, if we're, again, putting our finger on the scale, using affirmative action, we are in effect letting maybe underprepared students into top universities and setting them up for failure.
That's a very common critique, and the critique is sort of powerful because it suggests you're not helping the student. The problem with it is that, one, there are studies on both sides, and people talk about overmatching is the term for it. And there are some studies that suggest overmatching exists. There are a lot of studies that suggest most of the students who are admitted do just well. The reality is most students who apply and are rejected by elite colleges and universities could succeed there. It's not just those who are admitted. There's also a lot of research right now that says the bigger problem isn't overmatching, but undermatching. Students who aren't going to a college that is as competitive and offers as much as they might benefit from.
And another strategy I've seen suggested, I don't know if universities are pursuing this, is forget the affirmative action, but actively recruit in the populations you want to bring in. So you're not really changing your admissions, you're changing your marketing in a sense.
Absolutely. And so that may mean going to certain neighborhoods. It may be working with certain high schools that haven't historically sent as many students. It also may be going into the junior highs and elementary schools and starting to work with students at younger ages. In many high schools or many school systems, by sixth grade, many students have gotten off, say, the math track that you need to be on to be a competitive candidate at a top university. So some of the efforts to diversify the student body need to start quite early, well before anyone's applied to any college.
And speaking of that concept of reaching out into high school and before, as you were just pointing out, is part of the solution maybe trying to get more equity in the schools before the kids are at that high school stage, before they're applying for college?
I mean, certainly. The reality is if you look at things like number of AP classes, class size, number of guidance counselors, all kinds of measures favor some students over others. Now, it's important to say there are students who succeed in every kind of high school and over every kind of disadvantage. But the reality is high schools are not identical, and either in the opportunities they provide, the attention they can provide, nor are families identical in the resources that they bring. The reality is there are some families that can pay to go anywhere, to send their kids to private school, whatever they want. There are many others who can't. There are all sorts of inequities that come into play, not just who gets in where.
Scott, when I read your piece reacting to this Supreme Court decision, I looked through the comments section a little bit. There were a couple of comments, something along the lines of opposing quotas, racial and ethnic quotas at universities and colleges. We haven't had quotas for a while, really, have we?
Correct. I mean, the Bakke decision back in the late 70s barred colleges from setting aside set number of spaces for members of specific groups. Critics of affirmative action, though, claim that some colleges still try to achieve certain percentages in ways that they consider akin to quotas. But there are no colleges in the United States that have quotas as part of their official policies.
Scott, wrapping up, you've mentioned a lot of cases related to this in the past making their way to the Supreme Court, a lot more in the pipeline. Why is affirmative action in colleges and universities such a hot-button issue?
Well, it's about where the best and brightest get in. It's about principles of equity. It's about how much the United States is a country where anyone can succeed. Depending on how you come at this issue, any way you do, it relates to important questions of justice and fairness. And those kinds of issues don't go away because there are a lot of people who feel very strongly, in this case, in very different ways.
Scott, thanks a lot for joining us today.
My pleasure. Bye.
That was Scott Jasik. He's editor of Inside Higher Ed. We've been talking about today's U.S. Supreme Court ruling on affirmative action and state challenges to that in colleges and universities. As we observe Earth Day today, it's getting harder to ignore what can seem like a litany of almost daily bad news about the state of the planet. Even more daunting can be the question of how to loop kids in on the conversation about warming oceans, disappearing species, pollution, and doomsday scenarios about water wars and food shortages. So our next guest is here to help.
For today's Teach Me What You Know segment, we've got Brenna Holzhauer with us. Brenna is the Director of Exhibits and Digital Curricula at Madison's Aldo Leopold Nature Center, where she regularly works with children, educating them about the environment. Brenna, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you.
Well, first off, happy Earth Day to you.
Happy Earth Day.
Well, and from happy Earth Day to some of the more challenging news about the planet lately. There has been, as we all know, some challenges. There's climate change going on. Seemed like barrage sometimes with bad news about polar bears going extinct and other species extinction and just different challenges the climate is facing right now. How do we start a conversation with our children about that?
That's a really great question, and I think it's really important. And I think a lot of us in the field, we can get frustrated about all the bad news that we hear every day, but it's really important to think about kids and the fact that they can't really process all that fear and anxiety, and so we need to approach things a little bit differently when we talk with them. It's really important to focus on the positive with kids and the solutions that they can do, and to show by good example and incorporate them in household decisions and make them feel like they have a little bit of control over the situation. Especially for younger kids, I think the main thing you can do is just take them outside and get them connected with nature so that you can focus on kind of the good things about the environment as well.
And if children aren't bringing it up themselves, should parents take the lead and introduce the topic?
Yeah, definitely. It's not something that should be avoided, and I think it's important to acknowledge the emotions that they're feeling and make sure that they know that that's normal and that's okay, but that there are a lot of things we can do to help. Humans have been tackling large problems for a long time, and we can tackle this one together, too. You can also point out examples from your own lifetime that you've seen, success stories, environmental or otherwise, and then just approach the solutions that they can take together.
And in terms of getting kids involved in the solutions, do you think it gives them a greater sense of agency if they can do something about it themselves? You teach them about an action they can take that might help.
Yeah, I do. Kids really like to have kind of control over their immediate surroundings and then especially kind of the world around them. So even just little things that you can do together and get them in the habit make a really big difference. And it's important to talk about how these things can be collective actions and kids all over the world can be doing them together, as well as all the adults that are taking action too. And it really makes a big difference.
Well, what are some suggestions for things we could have kids do that might make them feel better, collective and otherwise?
Well, there are the simple things that you hear a lot, like just changing a light bulb, turning off lights when you leave a room. And I think it's important when you're doing those things to talk about why you're doing them and how it kind of connects to some of the larger issues. And then there are things you can do just in your everyday lives, decisions that you make together at the grocery store about food that you're buying, You can make sure you turn your car off when you're waiting to pick up a friend so you're not idling. You can, especially kids, can get in on helping to arrange carpools and making sure they're riding bikes. And just little things really do add up. And then you can take on larger projects as a family. You could plant a garden in your backyard. You could look into installing solar panels. You could get kids involved in school with environmental clubs or making changes in the cafeteria or getting recycling programs started.
Have you seen kids who are upset about it, who seen some of the news? Because not all of it is pretty. If you tell a kid, you know, polar bears may be going extinct, that's something that can be really upsetting. How do you deal with the emotions of it?
Yeah, we do see that. And I think kids especially, it's easy for them to, the scary things kind of stand out a lot more. They have a different frame of reference than adults, and they're maybe not able to rationalize some of the things that we can. And I think also they're aware that this is all going to happen in their lifetimes, and they're the ones that are going to have to deal with these problems. So it is definitely relevant, and the kids are feeling anxious out there. But like I said, I think just focusing on the positive and doing things together as a family, and just making sure that they know that education and awareness are important too, and they can talk to their friends about it, and they can connect with people online. And there are a lot of really great citizen science programs and apps on the internet that you can, so you can really see your collective impact because you're linking up with people all over the world.
Right. And you're a fan of getting technology involved, playing a part in this when it's appropriate. What sorts of things would you advise?
Yeah, I think there are a lot of really great resources out there. And we at the Aldo Leopold Nature Center, we like to make sure we're using technology in complement to getting kids outside as well. It is really important to have that connection with nature. But there are a lot of really great resources out there that can help you explain climate change to your kids. Some great websites, some great animations, and some of these abstract concepts are hard to visualize. So it's nice to be able to find some of the videos and books that are out there and websites. And then the citizen science apps that I mentioned and some of the websites where you can actually get involved in collecting data outside and you can help compile it and compare with other areas and compare with years prior so you can feel like you're contributing to science too, because scientists are using the data.
What kind of data?
Well, something we practice at the Nature Center is called phenology, which is the science of appearance. And it's basically just observing and recording things that you see in the world around you. And it is really important in science, but it's also just a really easy, accessible thing you can do with your family. Anything like observing birds that are coming and going, migrations, just things you see in your backyard, buds that are sprouting. And it's just a fun way, especially if you keep records from year to year, you can compare what's happening with the seasons and with the weather, and that can lead to some great conversations about climate and climate change as well. And then you can keep your own family records or you can enter them into some of these bigger collective databases too.
I was thinking about how the UN recently issued a report that seemed to sort of shift the conversation from how to stop climate change to how to survive it, because it sort of seems as though it's already rolling on. How realistic should we be? Do we have an obligation to be honest with our kids, even if it's, you know, going to scare them?
Well, I think it's important to talk about adaptation along with mitigation. And so mitigation is all the actions we can take to curb climate change, curb emissions, and try to prevent a lot of these future worst case scenarios. But a lot of these things are already happening and a lot of them will continue to happen for the decades to come. And so it's really important to also be studying and discussing and focusing adaptation. And humans in general and our society is pretty adaptive. And so there are a lot of things, especially with new technologies and renewable energy and even just some ecosystem management and things like that, that we can do to kind of help protect the resources that we have and adapt to what's already to come.
So maybe should it be age appropriate, depending on how much of the, you know, the truth, you know, such as we know it, you want to let kids in on? Or, you know, is it okay, appropriate what's for a 13-year-old, the same is appropriate for a 6-year-old?
It definitely, the conversation should change as kids get older. When they're really, really young, the most important thing is to connect them with nature, get them interested and curious, and also understanding and feeling compassionate about what they're seeing. And you'll kind of lay that environmental ethic and that feeling of stewardship that you can build on as they get older. And you can also just introduce very simple concepts like talking about the weather and talking about the water cycle. And you maybe don't even have to mention climate change or global warming. or some of the scarier things. But then as kids get older, you can start to connect the dots a little bit more. It's a really complicated, complex topic, and so there are a lot of different angles and ways to approach it. And the best thing you can do is just kind of keep building on it as kids get older.
Well, let's focus in on the getting kids connected with nature aspect of it, because that's part of your specialty and part of what the Alda Leopold Nature Center does, getting kids connected with nature. What are some, I guess, baby steps to forging, not just getting kids outside, that's part of it, but part of it seems to be having them emotionally invested in the natural world, which is sort of the next step. How do you get to that step?
That's a great question, and that's sort of our mission at the Nature Center. We follow in the words of Aldo Leopold he said we should teach the student to see the land, understand what he sees, and enjoy what he understands. And so that's what we do, and I think the more often kids can get outside and the more quality time they can have, the more they'll appreciate and be interested in what they're doing. And I think having lots of good hands-on interactions is what's important, and really just making it joyful and letting them enjoy what they're doing, having great experiences and being able to ask questions and look things up together and just learning together. Really just getting their hands dirty and letting them kind of have free play outside is really important.
So getting some field guides, maybe identifying flowers and bugs and birds, that
yeah,
kind of thing?
Yeah, just going for hikes, going fishing, anything you can do to get outside and bring resources, and even some of those mobile apps that have some good identification and good questions you can look up together.
And as far as some of the, you know, the scarier things that we hear about from time to time, not everyone agrees on these because there's still a lot of different opinions, but you have people predicting water wars and food shortages and civilization collapse, things like that. Is it okay to shelve that for a while and focus on the mission you're talking about, just getting them to connect with nature?
Yeah, I think that is really important, and they'll have time as they get older to kind of build on that and tackle some of the scarier things. And I think it's also really important to stress that we can solve these problems by being innovative and creative and just learning as much as we can about the science and the technology, and maybe someday they'll be able to invent something that will help solve some of these problems too.
So you work with children regularly as part of your job. Are you seeing kids that have the connection you're talking about and are dealing in creative ways with climate change, even though they're children?
Yeah, we do. It's really great to just see the creativity kids have. And we'll go through a lesson and talk about some of these things, and we always make sure to end on a positive note and talk about solutions and what kids can do. And I've been blown away by some of the solutions they have, and some of them may or may not be realistic with current technological limitations, but maybe by the time they're adults, they'll be able to make that a reality. So it's pretty exciting.
But it sounds like they're thinking about it.
Yep.
And they're connecting, and that sounds like what you want at this stage.
Yep, that's the best we can do for now with kids, and just get them interested and concerned and passionate, and hope that they can help us through some of these problems of the future.
Do you have anything else exciting planned after this for the rest of your Earth Day?
I'm actually heading back to the Monona Terrace for the Nelson Institute Earth Day Conference. It's been a great day so far, and we have a banquet and some presentations this evening, so it should be fun.
Excellent. Well, Brenna, thanks for making time. I know you've got a busy day. Thanks for coming by.
Yeah, thank you for having me. Happy Earth Day.
We've been talking to Brenna Holzhauer, Director of Exhibits and Digital Curricula at Madison's Aldo Leopold Nature Center.